Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and once again, we are talking about how lacrosse recruiting works, this time with Denver head coach Matt Brown. Brownie, how's it going? Great to see you.
Yeah, great to see you, Terry. Thanks for having me on. It's going great. Exciting times, obviously, with September 1st this past weekend, and for us, the Pioneers, we just moved our freshmen in this past Tuesday, so lots of action happening right now.
No doubt. So we're recording this on Friday, September 6th. It'll probably run the following Wednesday. And, you know, part of that means exactly what you just said, which is relative to the first five that came out in August. This is the second that we're recording after September 1st. And that means that you're able to have first contact with high school juniors. How's it been? How would you characterize it?
I think it's been great. You know, we've had some great conversations with a wide variety of young men from, you know, all over North America. And it's been some good interest. You know, probably my favorite part of this whole thing, of this whole process, outside of actually being on the road and reevaluating them, is to get to know these guys, who they really are. I think it's pretty easy to tell who has skill, athletic ability, who sees the field well, lacrosse IQ. But what are they really like as people? I think that's the most important thing in this whole process, and something that we enjoy the most.
So one of the conversations that I've had with you and with a bunch of your peers is about staying faithful to your guys. And I use that in quotation marks. Every program has their guys, and some guys fall out of that. They're not their guys. That's okay. Every program's different. And sometimes there are really talented players who are not their guys. And they might not necessarily, those players might not realize that they're not your guys. So they might want to come and play for Denver. And it's way more likely that that happens when you make a trip to the Final Four, which you just did. So my question is, how do you balance the temptation of bringing in the best available talent while also understanding that you have to be faithful to bring in your guys?
Yeah, I don't think we change, you know, much from when we started this thing, when Coach T and I got, you know, together in 2010. You know, we're different out here in the West, and we know that, and it takes you know, somebody that wants to do something different. And again, you know, I think if you look at us and from the last 15 years or so, you know, we attract guys from all over the country. You know, we're not just focused on one particular area. Obviously, you know, homegrown talent is important to us. Obviously, Canadian talent has been one of the main reasons why we've been successful here. But we're looking for anyone and everyone who kind of fits into what we believe in as a program. And as I mentioned, now's the exciting time when you get to actually sit down and meet with the families and learn who these guys are outside of just their lacrosse playing abilities.
So let's start with those two topics. Homegrown talent, the importance that Denver Pioneers are to the Denver lacrosse ecosystem, the Denver lacrosse community. You know, obviously, whether it was the CCBL or the U.S. Boxla or the Denver Elite club team, there's been so much infrastructure development that you have been a part of overseeing. It's a chicken or the egg question, because the Denver Pioneers' on-field success and the University of Denver's support of the program certainly goes a long way toward the pinnacle aspiration of developing all of that foundation, right? But then on the other end, you've had some of the best players in the program have come through that development pipeline. Because it's a chicken and the egg thing, I don't really have a question. I'm just asking you to pontificate on what it means, how you did it, and what you've learned and kind of where it currently sits.
Well, one of the reasons why we started Denver Elite, you know, many years ago was for that, to give kids locally here a kind of a Division I coaching lacrosse experience at a young age, at the youth level, and then into high school. But lacrosse here in general in Denver is just, it's gone crazy. And I look at When the Mammoth came into town, I believe that it might have been early 2000s, 2001. Then you have the Outlaws, obviously Coach T coming west, us being able to win a national championship. There's just been a steady stream of success stories here in Denver, which has captured new fans, new participation. When you tie all of that stuff into the type of atmosphere that we have on game days, and it's pretty cool that we have a number of guys on our current roster that have been sitting in the stands with lacrosse stick in hand, shirts off, rally towels over top of their heads, that grew up watching Dylan Johnson, Colton Jackson, Eric Law do this thing, who were from Denver, and now they get that opportunity. And so, it's the chicken or the egg, but no matter which one comes first, it needs to happen. And we need to continue to do that here. And so Denver players, Colorado players are really important. And hopefully we have more of them for many years to come.
I want to take a little bit of a left turn, but I think you'll be able to appreciate this because you played at Denver. You have lived in Denver for, at this point, 20 plus years. So you can speak to how unique of a place it is. And the left turn is, so I got my start professionally in media writing for the Baltimore Ravens website in 2007. And one of the players on that team was Trevor Price, who was at that point late in his career and had been a stalwart for the Denver Broncos defensive line. He's one of the most kind of intellectual and interesting professional athletes I've ever spoken to. And he went on to write a lot, actually, for the New York Times after he finished his career. And I remember very vividly and very distinctly, because it was such a bizarre conversation to be having in an NFL team locker room, but I talked about, like, basically what it meant to be with the Ravens. Or I asked him a question about it, with the implication being, this is a team that won the Super Bowl in 2000 or 2001, and that they had just come off of a 13-3 season or whatever. And he kind of, like, shut me down. He's like, man, this is not big. Basically, this fan base exists from, like, the, northern suburbs of D.C. to the southern suburbs of Philadelphia. Like, I can drive from, like, the beginning of Raven Country to the end of Raven Country in, like, 90 minutes. Whereas, when I was with the Broncos, we were the professional team for, like, 13 states. Like, you couldn't cover them all in, like, a week, much less a day or even an hour. And that really shed a lot of light onto, like, how I have thought about Denver. And it's not just lacrosse, because, you think about what it was like for the Colorado Avalanche to arrive in the mid-90s, and they immediately are winning, Stanley Cups and having these epic series with the Red Wings. Denver as a sports town is very unique because of the way in which it represents the entire Rocky Mountain region, by and large, with some exceptions. How do you feel like that has influenced the way that lacrosse has grown in popularity in concurrence with some of these other things that have happened sports landscape-wide in Denver?
Yeah, it's been huge, and I think you're bang on, especially when in the lacrosse world, outside of now Utah, being added into the mix. Before that, it's been us and Air Force. And we've been out here since 1999, Air Force probably before that. And so when lacrosse really started to become popular here in the West and they wanted to look to a college program, there was only one. There was only one college program here in the West. So as the expansion started to grow, and I have lots of thoughts on how it's grown in the West, I believe when the MLL moved out to LA and San Francisco, when you started to see more pro players moving to those locations and actually get involved in grassroots and starting to coach high school and being involved in youth programs, that's when we really started to see the growth of California and then Oregon and Washington and so on. But they all kind of look to us from a collegiate standpoint. And that still remains true. Now Utah is there as well, and thank goodness they are. It's always all of our dreams in the lacrosse world. I know you and I have talked about this many, many times about how can we get more of these programs to add. I know us being lacrosse guys, we kind of scratch our head. Why wouldn't they? It's the greatest sport on the planet. And it would be a great addition to many institutions for many reasons. But you're exactly right. And so those comments about the Broncos, we feel the same way about the Pioneers. And really that's across the board with all of our athletics. So We're just blessed to be out here. We're blessed to be at an institution that cares about lacrosse. I've said it many times, and I'll continue to say it. We're a lacrosse school, and I feel great about that, and I'm so thankful for that. And I know it will continue to get better.
So let's talk about one of the other geographies you mentioned, and that's Canada, and it's where you're from, and specifically British Columbia. Let's start just by distinguishing, what are the differences culturally and lacrosse-wise about BC versus Ontario?
Very different, very different. I grew up in the West. We always said West was the best, but it's totally night and day. You look at Ontario, there's just more volume, there's more centers, there's more clubs, there's more participation, and it's really spread out. You could drive 2.5-3 hours for an away game, whereas in British Columbia, mostly everything is concentrated in the Lower Mainland or the island. And so in the Lower Mainland, the longest commute is 45 minutes. When you look at the players that have come out of those places, and there's always some few exceptions, but yeah, I would probably give you that the typical stereotypes of Canadian lacrosse players are, the West are the big, strong, athletic guys, and the East has got the silky, smooth hands that might be a little bit slicker. And so it was always interesting growing up to see the contrast in styles of play. And I'll be honest with you, I think you saw a perfect example of that a couple weeks ago in the Minto Cup that just occurred out in Coquitlam. You had a more, I would call, defensive-minded team in the ADNACs who really committed to playing sound defense as a unit, led by Ty Banks and some other greats. And then you had a much more gifted, talented, offensive powerhouse of a team in the Orangeville Northmen, and it was neat to kind of see them battle it out. I thought that was just some of the best lacrosse I've seen in years. And so Canadians, as we've talked about, have been really a pillar of the reason why we've been successful here. And it kind of started with Jeff Schneider coming down, who oddly enough was a face-off guy who really started the face-off movement here. We face-off you at the University of Denver, and then followed up by many other greats.
Yourself included.
I don't know about, I wasn't a great, but I was here. So
what was your recruiting story? How did you get discovered, and what ultimately led you to decide that you wanted to be a Pio?
Yeah, my story was, I was a hockey guy through and through. I loved playing hockey. Like every young Canadian, you felt like you were going to grow up and hoist the Stanley Cup above your head. And I started to realize that wasn't going to be the case. So I was playing lacrosse, and I knew nothing about college lacrosse, but I was working at a Safeway in the early morning shifts on Sundays. And I came back to the house and I said to my dad, I said, I don't think I want to be doing this the rest of my life. And he said, well, what are you going to do about it? And so I started sending emails out. This is when internet first, was invented, the old dial-up. And I sent a note to Denver and Jamie Monroe, and he called me within 45 minutes of getting the email. And the next week I was down, and I was on a visit. And he had, I'll never forget, this is before Peter Barton. It was an old AstroTurf field, and he had some ladders that were kind of rigged together with a little bit of a platform where we could stand on, and we were watching practice. And he looked at me and he says, do you think you could play here? And I said, I think so. And from that moment on, I committed. The people here at Denver were just amazing. Ron Graham, who was our associate AD and ended up being our athletic director here, I sat in his office, and he was from Victoria, BC. And so there was some comfort there. He played in the NHL, and the Boston Bruins were my favorite team, and he was the goalie for the Boston Bruins. So, heck, I was like, this is meant to be. So that's how I first came down to Denver, and I'm so blessed to have had that opportunity and haven't left.
When you said, yes, I think I can play here, did you actually believe it, or did you just say it?
Well, I thought I could play from a standpoint of scoring the ball. I didn't think I was going to be able to take on any of those long poles. And I was I was correct, you know, at least on the second one. You know, I remember coming to fall practices and I couldn't carry the ball for more than three steps before it was back on the ground. And so it took me a while to get adjusted to the whole field game. But slowly but surely I did.
I want to drill deeper on that in terms of how you evaluate box players, projecting them for the field game. But before getting to that, I do want to ask about one more element of your individual experience, because and forgive my ignorance, this was a little bit before my time, but you know, I started inside lacrosse in the fall of 2007, so shortly on the heels of Zach Greer and Garrett Billings kind of being that wave of popularization, right? Like, you know, you were, I guess, a year or two older than Zach, and so, you know, I know John Grant Jr. was probably 3 or 4 years older than you, so it wasn't as if, you know, there was this kind of like steady line. But, you know, that was also kind of the beginning of a proliferation, whereby the other thing that happened was a lot of guys who had committed to come play college lacrosse, and for whatever reason, like, it couldn't work out academically. Now, I know in some instances it was 13th grade, in other instances it was, you know, SATs, because they hadn't taken the SATs, whatever else that might have been. How was your academic translation, so to speak, from Canadian schooling into DU?
Yeah, mine, unfortunately, was really easy, you know, because of the high school that I went to, St. Thomas More Collegiate, which was an all-boys private Catholic school, and so it prepared me for you know, American University. So that wasn't an issue for me, you know, whatsoever. Honestly, I probably had more struggles on the field than I did in the classroom. But to your point, it's you know, I'll never forget, and I believe it was Inside Lacrosse, the old newspaper magazine, and there was a picture of myself and Sean Greenhall. And Sean Greenhall went to Cornell, and it said Maple Leaf Invasion, and that was the title of it. And, you know, prior to that group coming down, and there was a few others in that class that came down to the States, you had Junior, and obviously you had Paul and Gary that kind of led the way and paved the way for all of us. But then after that, you started to see this thing really grow. And one of the things that I talk about frequently with people was, what was pretty amazing is I tried out for the Canadian national team in 2005. And when you went to the Canadian national tryout, there was probably only five guys that had field lacrosse helmets on in that year. Everybody else was wearing their box helmets. And then you know, you fast forward 4 years later to 2009 for the 2010 ones, about half had field helmets and half had box helmets. And then you fast forward again to 2013 for the 2014 World Games, pretty much almost everybody, there was only a couple guys, Dan Dawson being one of them, that didn't have a field helmet. And nowadays, not only do they have field helmets, but they're representing every college and prep school there is in the country. So it's an interesting timeline, and that kind of paints a clear picture of, you know, the true Maple Leaf invasion of college lacrosse that has occurred.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, from my point of view, so it was March of 2008 when Brody brought the second Hill Academy team, because I think they played their first season in 2007, to Baltimore. And if memory serves, that was the year that they beat Loyola Blakefield after Loyola had beaten or had won the MIAA championship the year prior. And so, you know, the likes of Randy Stotts and Jason and Jeremy Noble and so many other great players that were on that team. That was the whole thesis, right? Was, you know, Brody had gone, I believe it was to Salisbury in order to be able to make his way to Georgetown. And basically the family was like, do we need to do this? Or can we provide, you know, an at-home opportunity to you know, start to create this? And there have been, you know, many, many more that have followed suit in the intervening years and among other aspects of kind of the educational system development, as well as, you know, Americans understanding, you know, what needs to be done in order to prepare Canadian students in order to matriculate. It is really remarkable the amount of progress that's been made in that area. I say that, and yet it's been 20 years. So maybe it's not remarkable. Maybe it's just like, yeah, this is normal evolution. I guess we're just, you know, it feels more recent to me.
Well, what Brody has done single-handedly for the Canadian lacrosse player has been, it's unbelievable, absolutely remarkable. You know, I look at what Jeff Schneider is doing in Alberta, and there's more now that in other areas of the country that are trying to help and support and give, you know, Canadian lacrosse players more opportunities to play in the States. But Brody really was the pioneer of that whole thing. And his vision, along with his dad and his family and his brother, to start the Hill Academy, just amazing. We were fortunate enough to recruit Jeremy from that first trip. And I'll never forget watching them play. They played a different style of lacrosse than everyone else. That ball was not in your stick for more than 2 seconds. And I think all the coaches on the sideline, they weren't accustomed to seeing that. Their jaws just dropped, and they're like, "Wow, this is unbelievable." And so, Brody deserves a ton of credit for all the opportunities that a lot of these Canadians have received.
We're going to come back to that stylistic thing, but I do want to get into how you evaluate a box lacrosse player playing in a box lacrosse setting as a prospective field lacrosse player. What do you look for? What are the telltale signs that a guy could be good? And what are the red flags that maybe this guy's game won't translate?
Yeah, I think the easy ones for everyone to tell is, you know, who's scoring the goals, who can finish the ball, you know, put it in the back of the net. The thing that I look for is the movement on the court. You know, I think and that's probably a little bit trickier to see if you're not used to watching a ton of box. I think it's easier to see on the field, but you think about how many opportunities, how much change of direction, between pick play, playing offense, playing defense, transitioning, navigating obstacles. There's way more contact. There's way more obstacles that you need to navigate because it's in such a confined area. I love watching how the guys move. You know, I think that's a big piece of it. The other thing is ground ball play. And one of the reasons why you see a guy like Zach Currier or a guy like that we had like Jeremy Noble or somebody like Colm Barnett in our team who was played for Orangeville, they're phenomenal on the ground. You know, they truly are vacuums. They pick this thing up, and it's because it's just so many more opportunities. The ball bounces differently on concrete. You got to play it off the wall. And so you start to learn and figure out your angles and how do you go about picking it up and protecting it in a variety of different ways. And so those are things that I love to look for. And then I think the last piece of it that I think is you can tell better in box than you can potentially in field is the toughness aspect. And I'm not talking about just hacking and whacking. I'm talking about, you know, who gets to the middle of the floor. You know, it's the guys, and we say this all the time, the guys that are true champions in the indoor game, in the box game, are the guys that play in the middle. They're not the guys that play in the perimeter that just kind of arc back and forth. You know, those types of guys you want to shy away from. It's like watching field lacrosse, and the guy catches it down low, and he doesn't finish across the far pipe, and he kind of drifts and fades and shoots it. You know, that's a big no-no in coach's eyes. And so I love watching box from that standpoint to see who's tough, who will get to the dirty places, and who will take a beating and not retaliate. You know, I think growing up, I had the privilege of watching Paul and Gary play almost every Saturday night when they were in Victoria. And the thing that stuck out to me the most about in particular, you know, both of them, but Paul, as I loved Paul as a player, is he would get to the middle, he would score, guys would bear hug him, they'd pull him down the ground, they would smash his head into the concrete, you know, after the whistle, and he had no reaction. He popped up, he jogged off, he tapped his teammates, he got onto the bench, and he went out in the next shift, and he did it all over again. And to me, and I use that a lot with our current team and with everybody that I coach at all different age groups, that's what being a tough offensive lacrosse player is all about. You know, taking a beating and not reacting and responding and doing it over and over and over again.
That was an incredibly thorough answer, and I think that you provided a lot of attributes that span the gamut of box players translating or transitioning to field. But there are a couple of things I want to follow up on specifically with respect to positions, because I think that most folks conceive, and this is kind of where you started your answer, of the most valuable or kind of scarcest resource of a Canadian player is the finishing, right? Their ability to, shoot on a 4x6 goal with a goalie that's a lot bigger than an American field or a field lacrosse goalie. But as you said, whether it's, I mean, I don't know. At this point, there's too many examples to name. But Zach Currier or, a number of All-American Canadian defenders. Obviously, we've talked about face-off guys. Specifically with respect to defenders, like what Ty Banks, you already brought him up. If Ty Banks were to be recruited exclusively off of his box film, what would it be about what he does in box that gave you the most confidence that he was going to be a good field lacrosse player?
I'll go back to footwork, as number one, intensity, pressure on the ball. When you look at, successful defenders in the field game, those guys, in my opinion, are guys that can get their hands on you and stay on you. It's not the guys that can run necessarily just in a straight line. It's not the guys that have a fancy stick to throw checks, although those are added pluses. But from a foundation of defending the ball, you need to get your hands on guys and you need to stay on guys. And so so those two things that I would look at. What's the one thing? Let me ask you, Terry. What's the first thing? What's the most important thing that a D coordinator says to his team about playing defense? What do you need to be able to do?
Yeah, so I think that there's two answers that are most illustrative as to your style. So either don't get beat is one guy's answer, or like we defend with six. Right. So I don't know. Is either of those the one that you were going for?
No, they're not.
Oh, come on.
But it's OK. The first thing I would say that every D coordinator would talk about, communication.
Communicate. OK.
Communication. Right. And this starts at second grade all the way up to the pros. You heard Jim Stagnita on the PLL the other night talking about communication. And so it's communicate, 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 communicate. Well, where do you have to communicate the most? You have to communicate the most in box cross because it's like basketball. There's screens, there's picks, there's switches. You're covering, there's so much contact there. You got to be on point with your teammate. And so when you look, and going back to your question of like what would stand out when evaluating a defender in a box game is how well does he communicate? And we all know that's just not with your voice. That's with your body. That's with your hands. That's with your posture. And so that's something that we would watch a great deal and determine, okay, if he can do that at a high level, then he's going to be able to handle that on the field pretty darn easily.
Along those lines, what was Casey Wilson's kind of recruiting story? What is he as a box player, and how did you discover him?
Yeah, so it's funny. Casey is... sometimes you get defensive guys in box that will come down and play offense in field,
right.
Because they're athletic, because they've got speed and they've got some hands. Casey's the opposite. Casey was a 100-point scorer in junior A lacrosse, and that's how we recruited him. I got a call from a good friend of mine, Chris McKay in Victoria. This was at the end of July. Saying, Brownie, you got to take a look at this guy. He's had a phenomenal summer. I kind of knew his name because I'm always tracking the stats. And
yeah.
I watched him play a game at the beginning part of the summer. And so I got on the phone with Casey and fell in love with him as a person. And we turned it around pretty quickly. And he came down about 3 weeks later. And he was joining us on the field. And we got out to practice. And
so that was before his freshman year of college?
It was before his freshman year of college. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I thought you were talking about like late July of his going into his last year of high school.
No, before his freshman year of college. So in essence, 3.5-4 weeks, about a month before college started.
And this ends up being the only college player on the 23 Canadian national team.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And so he, and on top of that, you know, he was an O guy in box. He scored 100 points. He was on the right side. He's playing in the Man Cup for the Victoria Shamrocks. He's out the front door, and he comes down to us, and we're doing small-sided drills like everybody does early in the fall, and you play offense and you play defense as from a midfield standpoint. And the next thing you know, we're watching him, and he just sits there and covers guys, and he's moving, you know, minimally. You know, he's not too aggressive, but he's not too soft. He just kind of sits there and pushes you and walls you off and covers you. And we looked at each other, Coach and I, and Coach Gallant, and we just said, wow, I think we got to make this guy D-Mitty. And we had some need there in that position. But then on the flip side, you know, he brings a ton of value in clearing the ball. He brings a ton of value in pushing the ball in transition. You know, you can be creative now in substitution games or early offense opportunities. And so Casey's one of the rare guys that has gone the other way. He plays offense in box and he plays defense in field.
Interesting. Last one in this line of questioning, because again, you know, just trying to isolate the difference in positions and not all offensive players are just goal scorers. Do you consider Jeff Teat to be a quarterback in field lacrosse?
I do. Yeah,
okay,
I do.
So do I. What could you see that as a box lacrosse player? Meaning, you know, and if so, are there any others that, you know, significantly come to mind in terms of being able to quarterback an offense as opposed to being the complementary finishing piece, or, you know, even the Dodgers, right? Because there are obviously a lot of Dodgers that you guys have created as well, but not necessarily like that quarterback is a much more rare thing to find in Canada relative to the two-handed traditional quarterback, ex-attackman, that, you know, tends to be American.
Yeah, Jeff's an interesting one when it comes to box and how does that translate to field. You know, I remember watching him like it was yesterday, you know, playing in the midget provincials. And he's just always had phenomenal vision. You know, I think, you know, somebody said this the other day in the PLL about, you know, he's the Wayne Gretzky of lacrosse. And I would tell him this is that Wayne's the great one, but you're the next one. And I truly believe that about Jeff. So you always knew that he had the vision and the feel and the ability to feed. What you didn't necessarily know at the time when he was playing box was, could he handle the physicality and was his footwork elite enough to do so? But he showed us all that it definitely is. So that was a little bit harder to see. I think when you look at from an X standpoint, you know, we had somebody who I feel is similar, in Eric Law. You know,
sure.
Eric Law played a different but similar type of game, and for us at least, where, you know, he's not necessarily going to pick the ball up off the end line and run by you like a Michael Sowers or a Mikey Powell, but he's going to learn to play angles well. He's going to do the hang-up game well. He's going to learn how to get his feet, his hands open, you know, off ball. The thing that impresses me the most about Jeff is how, you know, you can't really lock him up. You know, you feel like when you watch these games, especially this summer, and he's going on some of these just monster defenders that are so strong and physical, you feel like it's going to be a turnover. And it actually is not, and usually ends up being resulted in a scoring opportunity for him, or even in most cases for one of his teammates. And so he's got this phenomenal ability of not getting sticky with his defender, which is hard to do.
All right. So I mentioned that I wanted to come back to the stylistic appeal of watching a very Canadian-oriented team play field lacrosse. You're in a really advantageous position to answer this because you are leading the revolution of Americans playing box lacrosse. I have heard from some of your peers that at the youth level or at that, you know, freshman, sophomore year of high school level, some Canadian programs have emphasized field lacrosse too much to the point where they've Canadianified their box teams. Do you see that, and is that a concern?
Huge concern. I stress it all the time. Anytime I'm in Canada and talking to club organizers, players, My biggest point of emphasis is stop playing more field lacrosse and make sure that you continue to play box lacrosse, even more box lacrosse, because it's what has made us special in the past. It's what's made us different in the past. And if you don't do that, then you're going to lose that knack. And on the flip side, and you're seeing it, there's more and more American kids playing box lacrosse year in and year out. It's happening. And I think, why is that happening? I think, American players, youth players are realizing how fun the game is. You know, once you experience it a few times and you go to a tournament, one, the parents don't know the rules, so that's great. That's fantastic, right? And of course, that's right. And then secondly, there's no hiding. You know, you make a mistake, you move on, you can't dwell on it. You go hard for 30 seconds, you get off, you get a squirt of water, and you're back at the front door, you know, ready to go. And I think guys really enjoy it. You know, we've had a ton of our college kids play in the college leagues, not just here in Denver, but across the country. The National Collegiate Box Series tournament now that happened last 2 years up in Utica. The level of lacrosse that's being played there is at a much, much higher level. I'm really excited to watch the World Box Championships that's going to be there at the end of the month. And so I think the biggest negative thing that Canadians can do is try to think that they should play more field lacrosse, because it's not going to help them. You know, Brody Merrill played very little field lacrosse. Jeremy Noble played very little field lacrosse. It was just at the Hill, but he played a ton of box lacrosse. Wes Berg played hardly any field lacrosse. And if you ask all of those guys, if you ask any Canadian that has come down to the United States and played collegiately, they'll tell you that the reason why they've been successful is because they've played the indoor box game.
So we've covered two of the three C's, with California being the third, and you already mentioned it earlier. That's kind of now a proxy to include Oregon and Washington. But what may have changed, and I'm going to frame it as a question, over the last 10 years is the secret's out. And so now you've got a lot more competition for those guys from your peers. And there might be more willingness or greater willingness for some of those great California players to go all the way across the country in numbers that they previously didn't. Have you felt it, or do you still feel like you've got some of the advantages in California that you did, say, you know, in that 2010 to 14 range?
Yeah, I think you definitely have felt it. You know, I think the game in California has just it's grown a lot. There's a lot more talent out there, and it's the same thing holds true as Canadians. With more and more Canadians coming down, it seems like everybody has at least a couple on their roster now. I think that's probably holds true for the California players as well. There's more California players spread throughout a variety of different rosters. You know, heck, they're going to Long Island to play for, you know, St. John's and Stony Brook and Hofstra as well. And so if they're going to go there, they're going to go anywhere. You know, it's just, which is a good thing for our sport. It really is. But I do still believe that we attract, a good handful of them. We are still a hot spot for them because of being in the West and representing the West and, you know, our success. A lot of times if they want to go to travel when they're youngsters and their family or their dad wants to take them out to a lacrosse game, you know, this is an easy one to get to. And we have a lot of Western families that come to Denver to attend games at Peter Barton. And so I still think that, you know, California is one of the C's. But as everywhere, it's all changing and it's all evolving. You know, we have guys from Idaho now. You know, we're recruiting kids from Oklahoma. We've seen kids from Alabama go play college lacrosse. And so there's great players and most importantly, great people everywhere across this country and in North America. And honestly, beyond. What I'm interested about is when do we start seeing the shift with the Olympic movement, with sixes, the growth of lacrosse internationally? When do we start seeing more international players, and there's been some now. It's been more popular last couple of years than not of them seeking out to have a college lacrosse, U.S. college lacrosse experience. When does that happen? And when that does happen, that's going to be exciting times.
No question. I mean, I think that, you know, I posted something after the Japanese women's U20 team beat, I believe it was England in the quarterfinals to position themselves for a potential bronze medal. And ultimately, regardless of the outcome of that game, you know, finished the highest that they were ever going to finish in an international tournament. And, you know, it's on the heels of being so impressed by the Japanese senior team in San Diego. And not just because I remember watching the Japanese at field level in 2010. And I would imagine that you had a similar experience as I did, which is, these are a bunch of very laterally quick 5'7 guys that move the ball super fast, but nobody wants to attack a matchup. In San Diego, 13 years later, these are a lot of 6'1, 6'2, 200-pound men who know how to put their shoulder and elbow into somebody dodging down the alley and make something happen. It was a remarkable, again, I mean, I'm just underestimating what can happen in 12 years. The challenge from a recruiting to an American university standpoint is one of the reasons it's flourished, at least as I understand it, to the degree that it has in Japan, is because they have a very well-organized university club system. And what that means is that a lot of guys are learning how to play for the first time when they're 18, 19, 20 years old. They're already in college, right? And so that opportunity isn't necessarily the same in order to go and recruit. But what I've heard, you know, in the wake of winning a bronze medal in Birmingham at the the World Games, that's what it was called. And then their success in San Diego, and now obviously with the U20s, and then, you know, the Nakazawa sisters, going to Louisville and showing that they can find success there. There is a growing desire, and then, you know, I think compounded with the PLL's trip over there as well, to start at younger levels and position, you know, their young athletes to be able to pursue, you know, the opportunity to play college lacrosse. And when that happens, that will be incredible because that will demonstrate a level of globalization that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's going to be exciting times when it does. And it will.
To shift into the last conversation I wanted to have before we let you get back to your day job. Your day job. You're in year two as the head coach. And we know because Coach T has said this on this podcast many times, that for the last however many years, you actually ran the ship and he just yelled at the refs. But with that being said, what was it like to take over the big chair, have to close the recruits, and now, you know, 1 year in, what did you learn last year that you intend to implement this fall from a recruiting standpoint?
Just that I'm lucky, you know, to have great people around me in our program. Last year was a great year. You know, obviously, you know, when the season ends, it's never, you're never happy and you're always disappointed. There's only one team that's happy at the end of this thing. But when you have a little bit of time to kind of sit back and reflect some, I'm really proud of all those super seniors that came back for a fifth year, you know, wanting to do it together. Not going anywhere else. You know, the type of year that we had, you know, we had some big moments last year and we're really proud of that. And I think that our younger guys that are coming back this fall have gotten a taste. There's nothing like going to Memorial Day weekend. It's truly the most special thing there is in our sport. And so, you know, those guys are motivated and it's shown with how hard they worked over the course of the summer and, you know, how great a shape they're in, you know, this upcoming fall. But, you know, just, I wouldn't say anything too different. You know, when you have David Metzbauer, who's, in my opinion, the all-time, you know, one of the all-time greatest coaches, definitely the all-time greatest assistant coach our sport's ever seen, and John Gallant, who's like a brother to me, we just had a lot of fun. And I think with how hard you work at this thing, and how much time and energy it takes to go into it. If you want to be successful, you got to make sure you're enjoying it. And I say this to our guys, our players as well, all the time, because the amount of commitment that it takes to be successful at this level, it's 10 times than what it used to be when I was in college. And so We're having a lot of fun, and I'm excited for a fresh new group. We've got 20 new pioneers on our roster this fall. We've got a great group of returners, a lot of guys that have been developing and kind of waiting in the wings that I'm really excited about that are going to be have their opportunity now, you know, to be out there. And so we start next Tuesday with our 8-hour weeks, and can't wait to get this thing going.
Well, that's a perfect note to end on. Matt Brown, we really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Thank you so much for your insight. This was very, very detailed. I already know of four or five people who are going to text me after listening to this about particular things that you said. And we look forward to watching the Pios this fall and certainly when you get back on the field in the spring and the games start to count for real.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for everything you do for our sport.
Oh, you're too kind.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.